So from the perspective of the ancient traditions and the understandings that we've gleaned as we've recovered the origins of some of our most cherished traditions, in the 20th century, this newly recognized form of energy that the experiments describe, this field of information that connects all of creation, scientists are beginning to look at this field as a tightly woven web. They're actually visualizing this and describing this is a tightly woven web that makes up what they call the fabric of creation. This field of energy, it's the stuff. It's in between the nothing. It's the precursor to everything we understand in our lives. When we look at an image of an atom and the model that we use with the nucleus in the center and the first electron orbiting, and it looks like there's a large empty space in between that nucleus and that first electron, in the place where it looks like nothing, this field of energy exists. We look into the vastness of the cosmos and we see immense distances between stars and galaxies and we think nothing is there. This field of energy appears to be precisely the stuff that fills up that space. When we speak of a field of energy that links all of creation, the idea itself, conceptually, that all matter is connected through this net or a web, actually may not be as new as it would sound to some people today. 100 years ago, in the late 1800s, this is an amazing time in the history of the world. Think about the names of the scientists and the researchers that were born during the late 1800s whose discoveries have played such a key role in our lives today. Names like Planck and Bohr and Einstein. These are the men that created the foundation of so many of the understandings that we have today, and they lived during a time when the idea that all matter is connected was actually very much in vogue, although there was a lot of controversy about precisely what this connection looked like. The idea that all matter connected through a net or a web of energy existed was very popular during late 1800s, and at that time it was given a name, and this is a name if you use in circles of science and physics today, they may laugh you right out of the room. It was actually called the ether, E-T-H-E-R, the ether field. It's a very controversial field. There were schools of scientists that believed that all of creation is linked through an ether field, and there were others that did not. And to put the whole matter to rest, a very famous experiment was conducted in 1887, a little over 100 years ago. And this experiment had such profound implications that it has affected science and engineering and the way we view our lives up until this very moment today. In our textbooks, in the textbooks of your children in school, the way I studied science and physics when I was in high school and college, are based in the results of an experiment that was conducted in 1887. It's the very famous Michelson-Morley experiment. The object of this experiment was to prove once and for all whether or not this field that is called the ether actually exists. Allow me to just explain the experiment to you in this way. If everyone listening to this program, if we were all in a room together, and at the same moment in time, we left the room and went out into nature, into the outdoors, and we all moistened our index fingers, and we held them above our head, and in the moment that we held our moistened fingers above our head, if we felt no wind against our fingers and concluded from that no air existed around us, that is the equivalent of the Michelson-Morley experiment. They believed that if this ether field, this web that links all of creation, if it's really there, that it should be moving and we should be able to detect its movement. So they designed an experiment to detect the movement. I believe it was a good experiment. In theory, I believe it was probably poorly interpreted during its time. And because they felt no movement in the wind, they concluded the field did not exist. And from the results of that experiment in 1887 up until very, very recently, physics, science, chemistry, geology, biology, the way we view our world, we have based our understanding, as good as it is, we've based our understanding of the world on the idea that nothing is connected on this subtle level, that the events that happen in one place are discrete and independent, have very little effect on what's happening somewhere else. For over 100 years, we have believed that our world is a world of separateness and distinct and individual events. that have no effect on one another based upon this experiment. And now all that is about to change. Well, with the recent experiments of the late 20th century, the understanding that there is something out there, that there is a field that exists, this net or this web, is in fact linking the events of our lives and our world in surprising and perhaps very unexpected ways, now we've got to find a new word for the field. We can never call this field the ether field again because of the connotations of the last 100 years. Today, the various scientists and researchers that are acknowledging the existence of this field have given it varying names. There are some that are actually calling this field the mind of God. Stephen Hawking, in his work in the late 1980s, 1990s, made the statement that if we could understand the way physics works, if we can understand these relationships, that we can actually understand the mind of God. Former Apollo astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell, when he's describing this relationship in these fields, he calls this nature's mind. And there are other scientists now that are giving this field a very technical sounding name. This is the 21st century, a new century, new millennium. We've got to have a nice, shiny new name to call this new field. They're calling this now the quantum hologram. The quantum hologram. Very technical sounding name. I will use the term quantum hologram throughout the remainder of this program to be very, very precise about what this field is, just so there is no confusion about how it may be referenced. If we were to define the quantum hologram of the many definitions that we could give it, perhaps the simplest is the following. We can simply call the quantum hologram, it's the stuff that lives in between the nothing, as we've just described. It's the stuff that's everywhere all the time. It's already there. So now, with this in mind, we have already now established a conceptual model. We've got a new vocabulary that will help us, and new understandings that will help us go back into those three experiments, and let's see what really happened. What was happening in those experiments? When the volunteer, when the donor, had a swab of his cells from the tissue of his mouth, they were placed in one room and he was in another room. And he had an emotional experience and his cells registered that experience. What was it that connected the donor and his cells? Were they really separated by distances of only feet in the same building or by distances up to 400 miles in the case when one was in Los Angeles and the other was in Phoenix? Were they really separated or were they still linked through this web of creation, the net, the quantum hologram? When we look at the experiment of the DNA inside the glass tube, the vase, where all the air was drawn out and the photons that were left, the little particles of light, when they aligned themselves along the DNA axis and the DNA is removed and the particles stayed in the same place. Why? What held them in place? What is it that they are connected to that allowed them to hold that form and to hold that shape? Why didn't they all just fall to the bottom of this vase? Were they really disconnected from the DNA, or were they still connected, even though the DNA was physically no longer in the vase? What is the hologram? Of the many ways we can define it, you can say it's the stuff that lives in between the nothing, because that's exactly what it is. It's a very non-technical description. Every place you think nothing, in the space between the nucleus of an atom and the first electron, where we think nothing's there, the hologram's there. In the space between our planet and the next planet, where we think nothing is there, there's always something there. There's always something present. Quantum hologram. Let's define what is a hologram, what it's made out of, and whether or not we're connected. I know you've heard the term hologram. It's used in many different ways in New Thought circles and means different things to different people. So I wanted to define it for us here today. First, what is a hologram? It's a pattern. It's a pattern of energy. Where every place you go in that pattern, all the information exists to recreate the pattern anywhere else. Everything you need is already there. It's going to be really important to understand how this works because it solves the mystery of what many scientists call miracles. In the way the miracles are actually working. In the Buddhist sutras, they say something very similar. Look at how interesting the language is. The Buddhist sutra begins, one of the Buddhist sutras, it says, "Far away in the heavenly abode of the great god Indra, there is a wonderful net that stretches in all directions." Then they go on to describe the net. See if this doesn't sound to you like a very ancient description
of the holographic principle. A glittering jewel hangs at every node, infinite in number. The surface of each jewel reflects all others in the net, so that the process of the reflection is infinite. How else? Now think of this. They don't understand quantum physics and quantum holography and geometry. In the language of their time, they're describing the information they've been giving of how our world is connected. This is an ancient description of the holographic principle. At the node point, everywhere in the net, there's something that reflects everything else in the net. That is non-local energy. Everything exists everywhere all the time as the potential, as the blueprint of that energy. Well, this quantum hologram is going to be the basis now for the remainder of this program as we view the events of our world, the healing of our bodies, the peace or lack thereof between nations. And people ask the question, what can we do? We feel powerless. There's only one of me and the world is so big. What is it we can possibly do? Well, it's this concept of the hologram that becomes so empowering for us to understand that every single one of us, every one of us, bar none, are vitally, vitally, critically important in the outcome of the events in our lives, in our world, because every one of us make choices in every moment of our lives, seemingly on a moment-by-moment basis, and all of our little choices, by virtue of the way the quantum hologram works, all of our little choices become the collective answer to our time and history. So understand how this works. I'm going to answer the questions. What is a hologram specifically? What is it made of? How does it work? How are we connected to the quantum hologram? I know that many people have heard the term hologram, and I know that it means different things to different people. It's used rather loosely in a lot of new thought discussions, new thought conversations. Maybe the best definition of a hologram, the best non-technical definition, is to simply describe the hologram as a pattern. It's a pattern in nature where every piece of the pattern holds everything that it needs to reproduce the entire pattern all over again. No matter how large or how small that piece is, it has everything it needs to reproduce the entire pattern. Let me give you an example. Maybe you've been to a bookstore in the last, 12, 15 years, and you've seen the bookmarks that are often given as gifts for the purchase of the books. They're very shiny strips. And when you hold them in the light in a certain way, the image inside the bookmark appears to become very three-dimensional and alive. And there are a number of these out there. I've seen one. One is the dolphin. One is Mother Mary. There's one that's a pyramid. There's one that's the face of Jesus. One that's a rose. If your bookmark is truly holographic, then you can do a little experiment. And you can only do it once, because when the experiment's finished, your bookmark will be destroyed. But the experiment is simply this. If it is truly a holographic bookmark, you can take a pair of scissors, and you can cut that bookmark into little tiny pieces. And then you can take those pieces and cut them in even smaller pieces. And even if you can't see them with your naked eye, if you put the smallest piece under a magnifier or a microscope and you shine a light into that tiny, tiny piece, if it's truly a hologram, you will still see the entire image reproduced in that hologram, if it is truly a hologram. This is an example of the way a hologram works. Think about a beautifully crystallized drop of water that looks like a snowflake. This is an example of a hologram in nature. When you look at that snowflake, or that crystallized drop of water under magnification, the symmetry, the geometry, every piece looks so delicate and fragile. And within every piece of that crystal lives all of the information to reproduce the entire crystal all over again. All of the geometry, all of the bond angles, all of the form and the shape to reproduce the entire pattern is inherent. It lives in every little piece of the crystal. If you were to cut that crystal in half, each half would have all that information again. And if you were to cut those pieces in half, they would have all the information again. And here's the beauty Here is the beauty of the hologram. The beauty of the hologram is that when we're creating this hologram, because every piece is a reflection of every other piece, because in every little piece the whole is mirrored, if we were to make a change anywhere in the holographic pattern, that change is mirrored throughout the entire pattern. I'm going to say that one more time. In a true hologram, if we are to create a change anywhere in the pattern of the hologram, the change that we create will be seen, it will be mirrored, it will echo and reverberate throughout the entire pattern. And the reason this is important is because it appears that we are holographic in nature, that our consciousness is holographic, that our beliefs are holographic. We know that our bodies are holographic, but in every cell of every human body, we have what is called the DNA, and the DNA has all of the information required to make another one of us. All it takes is one little piece of the DNA, and technically we should be able to make another one of us to reproduce another one. Within each part of the pattern, the whole is inherent. The whole lives. So in a true hologram, if we make a change in one place, and that change is mirrored throughout the whole, and we are, in fact, holographic in nature, what that says to us is that within each of us lives the power to choose peace, to choose life, to make life-affirming choices in every moment of every day, the way that we breathe the breath of life into our bodies, the way that we choose to nourish our bodies with life-affirming food, the way that we speak to one another and allow ourselves to be spoken to. All of these are choices that we make in each moment of each day in our seemingly insignificant lives, and all of our little choices become the collective answer into our holographic model of consciousness. And we may full well expect that the choices that we make in our individual lives then are mirrored back to us as the world around us. Within each of us lives the power to choose life or to make life-defeating choices, and the choice is purely up to us. The last time I was in Tibet, in the year 2001, we were going on a small pilgrimage around one of the temples in Tibet, and it's such an amazing experience. When we find ourselves in the presence of these temples, there are pilgrims who may have been journeying 6, 7, 8 months just to be at the place where we are, where we have arrived. We've just driven up on a bus, gotten off of the vehicle, and we walk up to the front of a temple where they may have walked 6, 7, 8 months just waiting to be there. And we honor them in their place in line, and we ask permission, and they invite us to join them on their pilgrimage treks. And we will do what are called circumambulations, very specific ways of walking in very specific directions around these sacred and holy temples, honoring what the temples represent. Well, in our pilgrimage around one specific temple, just outside Lhasa, the capital of Tibet, we came upon a man. He was a laborer, and he was sitting alone in the courtyard of a home, and he was surrounded by piles and piles and piles of flat stones, and upon every stone, beautiful letters in Sanskrit and Tibetan had been carefully chiseled. He was carefully chiseling every single letter by hand, and what the letters were is that they were words and phrases out of the Buddha's Bible that he was placing onto every one of these stones. And we sat and watched him for a while. Every letter was so perfect, and he was in such dedication, such devotion to the creation and the perfection of every single letter. And finally, through the translator, I asked, "What will you do with all these stones?" He said, "Look around you." And I looked around me and I didn't see anything, not what I was expecting to see. And suddenly it dawned on me, the buildings that were surrounding me, the walls of every one of the buildings were made of many flat stones that were stacked one on top of another, on top of another, on top of another. And the buildings were 4 and 5 stories tall. So we're talking about very large buildings in Tibetan terms. And it dawned on me that what I was looking at in the walls of those buildings were not simply flat stones. that were just randomly placed there, that every one of the stones that created the walls and the foundations of all the buildings around me, I was looking at from the side view. If I had been able to see them from the top, on every one of them were the letters of the sacred Hindu Bible that were carved on these stones. And through the translator, we asked him why he was doing what he was doing. And what he told us was this was his way of contributing to the peace of the world. He was telling us that as he became peace, the dedication, the devotion that he felt in the love with which he created every letter on every stone, he understood that by him embodying that to the degree that he could in his life personally, that it became more than a personal experience for him. It became part of the collective, and in that way, he was contributing to the whole in the only way that he knew how. He was contributing to the peace of his world. And this is just a small example. It invites us, however, to consider this in our lives. So many of us, as I have the opportunity to be in different countries and different cities, people say to me that they feel so powerless, helpless, to do anything about the wars between nations, about the suffering that we're seeing in the continents such as Africa and the droughts and the famines. The question that they ask is, what can we do? And it may be that in the simplicity of his life, this Tibetan man is showing us one of the most empowering, deceptively simple acts that we can do. And it is simply to become in our lives, in each moment of our lives, to become the very things that we choose to see mirrored back to us in the world around us. Knowing that as we become these things from within, through a field of energy that Western science is only beginning to understand, that ancients apparently understood very well, that what we become from inside is mirrored back to us, not only in our families and our communities, it is mirrored back to us in the policies between communities and between nations. And in that way, we all contribute to the health and the peace and the well-being of our families, communities, and nations. We all contribute to the things that we love and hold dear. So we ask ourselves the question, what is the quantum hologram? One of the answers that we may use to describe what the quantum hologram is all about is us. It is the way that we live our lives. It's the way we respond to the challenges of our lives in the presence of one another. And when we're alone and we think no one is watching, it's what we become from within, knowing that our actions are literally the fabric of the stuff that lives in between the nothing. The second question, what is it made of? What is our quantum hologram made of? This is a question when I had the opportunity to share this information with the young people in the senior conference that I spoke of earlier. Young people were very curious. And they said, well, if this net is really there, how come we never see it? How come we don't know about it? What is it made of? And I asked them the question back. I said, what could it be made of? What is the language of what the stuff of our world is made of? What is everything around us? The language of creation. And there were just a couple of people in the audience that answered back immediately. And I don't know if they'd heard this from their parents or if they've done this reading on their own. They answered back, vibration. They said, the stuff around us is vibration. Our world is all vibration. And they were correct. The quantum hologram appears to be a form, a highly refined form of a vibration. And it's a form that Western science simply does not discuss. I'm not going to say they don't acknowledge it. I'll say they simply don't discuss it much and may feel that it simply isn't relevant. In your mind's eye, I'm going to invite you to think of a graph that stretches from left to right. And on the left end of the graph are represented the long, slow vibrations of our world, what we call radio waves, broadcast waves. This is the stuff that carries the signals from our televisions and our radios. And on the other end of that graph are the very short, very fast, high-frequency waves we call X-rays, gamma rays, and then on up from there, cosmic rays. That graph, from the left to the right, from the long waves to the cosmic waves, is what today in scientific textbooks it's called the electromagnetic spectrum of information. What our science says to us today is that the events of our lives, the things that happen in our world, are what they are because of vibrations that we find that fall somewhere within that graph. From the long, slow radio waves to the very short, fast cosmic rays. Our world is made of vibration. However, what's so interesting about this is there's only one little tiny piece, one little piece of this entire spectrum that's called visible light. And it's within that little piece of visible light that all of the events we can see with our eyes occur. What the ancients knew is that everything in our world is what it is because creation is made of only five patterns of energy, and that's it. The atoms of our world, the molecules of our bodies, the stuff of this stage, of this wall, the way ice forms, they are all made of patterns of nature, atoms or molecules coming together following one or some combination of those five patterns. In sacred science, they're called the Platonic solids. And you know them as the tetrahedron, the octahedron, the cube, the dodecahedron, the icosahedron. If you don't know those, you're not familiar with them, you don't have to. The reason I'm sharing it is because when you see this, you know it's important. Even if you don't know about sacred geometry, and here's the reason why. You live every one of those patterns in the womb of your mother from the moment that you were conceived as a sperm and an egg. The sperm and the egg begin to divide following those patterns. This vibration is holding all five patterns simultaneously. All five patterns. What scientists have found, when you look at diatoms in the ocean, those tiny microscopic animals, and they form their skeletons, the very precise geometric shapes, why do they do it? They are tuned to patterns of geometry, and their skeletons are mirroring that geometry. That's what's happening. This is the stuff our world is made out of. Well, you know that. You know our world is made of vibration. Here's why this is important today. What you may or may not have considered, and we're not taught this in our culture, is that your emotions are vibration. Your feelings are vibration. Your thoughts are vibration. Thought, feeling, and emotion, separate yet related. As you learn to marry them in very specific ways, your thought, feeling, and emotion, that vibration interacts with the vibration of the world around you, and you elicit changes in your body and changes in your world that we're only beginning to understand. If there was ever any doubt in your mind that our world is made of pattern and geometry, pattern and geometry underlie everything that we know, that we can taste, feel, sense, smell, touch, create in our world on a physical level, and what researchers are now finding is on the non-physical level. The same laws govern the non-physical aspects of our world. These are powerful in your psyche. You'll think about these for a long time. Because your body is over 70% water. You have about 1 trillion or so cells in your body. Every one of those cells is holding a drop of water, and that drop of water is responding to whatever thought, feeling, and emotion you're holding in any given moment in time. From the moment you were created, the womb of your mother, inside the watery womb of your mother, until the moment you leave this world. The question is, are we aware of the patterns that we're holding in our bodies? Western science, this is one of the places where there's a huge gap and a glaring inconsistency. Ancient spiritual and religious traditions, in the language of their time, not only say to us, this is true, they take us one step further, and they say, this is how you apply it in your lives, and they give us step-by-step instructions if we have the wisdom to recognize that. And we see it in texts like the great Isaiah scroll, many of the indigenous traditions.
I have worked with scientists, and I've worked with engineers in the past, that say if we can't see it with our eyes, if we can't measure it with our machines, it doesn't exist. And they've said that to me. So they have said essentially they're not interested in any phenomenon that they cannot see in the visible light spectrum or that they cannot measure with the equipment that we have today. They said that if they can't do one of those two things, it doesn't exist. It's not there. And I asked them a question. I said, think of all of the things that you're missing by limiting your viewpoint, your perspective, to only the things that you can see or measure. What about the other stuff that's out there? And to them, it was of little consequence today. However, less than 100 years ago, at the turn of the century, in the late 1800s,
in early 1900s, when this tremendous spiritual revolution was sweeping the earth, and we had the great minds that we spoke of earlier, the Michelson-Morley experiment was conducted, and people like Einstein and Niels Bohr, Max Planck, minds like that were working with the electromagnetic spectrum, and they viewed it in many respects in ways differently than we do today. And here's one of those differences. If you, in your mind's eye, if you can consider the graph that we just described, from the long radio waves to the short cosmic and gamma rays and X-rays, think of that as one octave of information, just like on a piano keyboard, from C to C on a keyboard. That's one octave. And if you were to take that one octave and stack another octave on top of it, and then another octave on top of that, each time expanding the entire range by itself one more time and one more time, that would give you some idea of the context of what I'm about to describe. There were scientists and researchers in the early 1900s, late 1800s, such as John Keeley, Nikola Tesla, for example. Some scientists that are not taken quite so seriously today as they were 80 and 100 years ago. They were working with vibrations that were 30 and 40 octaves above where our electromagnetic spectrum leaves us today. 30 and 40 octaves. In other words, if you were to take that spectrum and stack it on top of itself 30 times end to end, or 40 times end to end, they were working with vibrations that were so fast, so highly refined, that the Western physics really doesn't even talk about them today. And when they worked with those kinds of vibrations, they achieved effects that to us appear to be miraculous and poorly understood. And by the way, they could never get patents on their equipment. I did a program recently, a very interesting program in the D.C. area. And in the audience, we were fortunate enough to have a gentleman from the U.S. Patent Office who was in our audience. And as I was sharing this part of the story, the gentleman shared with me how the patent process works. And he said two things. He said, first of all, for an inventor to receive a patent on an original piece of work, on an original idea, the patent officer has to be able to replicate or duplicate what the invention is doing. So the patent officer has to make it work. That's number one. And number two, and this is the one that really surprised me, he said the device, the invention, the discovery to receive a patent, the discovery must operate within the confines of accepted science and conventional wisdom. In other words, to you inventors out there, if your device, if your machine, if your invention is working with a form of energy that is not acknowledged in open textbooks and accepted by science today, it will not be granted a patent because it does not fall into the constraints of what is required to receive that patent today. So perhaps this may explain why the work of people like John Keeley and Rife and Reich and Tesla were never patented, because the researchers of the patent office could never duplicate the experiments, number one. Number two, the function was beyond the realm of conventional wisdom. It didn't work. People didn't understand the way it worked. The point to this discussion is our world is made of vibration. We live within vibration, within vibration, within vibration. At the most fundamental level, the vibrations create patterns in what's called the fabric of creation. And those patterns become atoms. Those atoms become the elements and the molecules that become rocks and trees and plants, birds, fish, animals, you and me. We are all, at our most fundamental level, energy in motion, vibration. And I think we all pretty well understand that. Well, the very interesting thing about this is that it is precisely this understanding that everything of our world is vibration that answers our question, what is the quantum hologram made of? It's made of the only thing it could be made of. It is a highly refined vibration that is so subtle, it has escaped detection through conventional wisdom, through conventional electronics, on the one hand. And on the other hand, now that we are delving into the quantum world and our experiments are carrying us into quantum effects, this field of energy is making itself known in ways that to many scientists and researchers are surprising and unexpected. Our world is made of vibration. You and I are vibration. And within that vibration, we are having experiences of thought, feeling, and emotion that are also vibration. Those vibrations interact with one another, and they produce the effects that we call our physical world. Quantum science beginning to tell us in their language, the ancients said in the words of their time, what that means in our lives. At this time in history, it's very empowering for us to understand that, because there's a sense by many people that our world is out of control, that illness and disease and suffering are out of control. That is a perspective, and there's another perspective that says there is no longer a them and an us. If there is a field of energy that bathes all of creation, we can't talk about them and us. We can't talk about the Al-Qaeda and the Israelis and the Palestinians, and we can't talk about people in Africa and other people, militant groups in our societies, and us. It means there is a we. A we. We are all accessing the same field of consciousness to some degree. We all are participating in the events that are unfolding in our lives. The quantum hologram is the form of vibration that allows everything to be what it is today. Our quantum hologram is the stuff that links us to creation, to the language of creation. It links us to one another. Well, it is precisely these understandings of our quantum hologram that is now leading us into the most ancient understandings of who we are and how we exist in our world. I think it's so interesting. It's so interesting that by going forward with the most sophisticated science in recorded human history, it's carrying us back and inviting us, beckoning to us to understand what the most ancient of our traditions and our ancestors were saying to us in the language of a very another time. So what can we say about our quantum hologram? At the very least, right now, we can say that our quantum hologram links us to the events of the world around us. It links us to one another. It links us to the healing of our bodies, to the joy and the sadness and the suffering and the ecstasy of all that we've ever loved and held dear. It links us to the peace between nations. There is a growing body of research suggesting it links us to the weather patterns, as typified by many of the traditions and the dances and the ceremonies of native indigenous peoples throughout the world. There's a growing body of evidence suggesting that there may be 6.2 billion people that walk this earth, and from the perspective of consciousness in the unified field, there's only one of us here. Now we have the opportunity to understand what that kind of connection means and how we may apply this unity, this principle of unity, into the greatest challenges of our time in recorded human history. The story of the Tibetan craftsman carefully carving each letter of sacred scriptures into the stones that become the foundations of entire buildings is such a beautiful example of the principle and the implementation of the principle of the quantum hologram and how the hologram works. Without knowing the technical understandings, perhaps, this man that I described, in his own way, through the simplicity of his life, he understands that the act of carving prayers of peace into these stones and feeling those prayers of peace in his heart is a mantra in each letter, in each moment of each day, as he's performing this very sacred act, is contributing to the collective experience of peace in our world today by virtue of the quantum hologram. This isn't just a metaphor or a nice idea. In the science of physics, particularly in chaos theory, there's actually a technical term that describes precisely how this relationship works. And the term is called sensitive dependence on initial conditions, although you may know it simply as the butterfly effect. The butterfly effect. It sounds deceptively simple, deceptively powerless, and the reality is that according to the science of physics and chaos theory, the butterfly effect may be one of the single most powerful experiences that we can undergo, and it's summarized in a single sentence. It simply says, if a butterfly flaps its wings in Tokyo today, a month later, it may cause a hurricane in Brazil. What it's saying, this principle is saying to us, the little things that we do in our lives are compounded over time, and they are mirrored throughout the world around us in ways that perhaps we're only beginning to understand. So, my question to you, from the perspective of viewing the world as a quantum hologram, and from the perspective of the things that we do in our lives, how are the actions that you choose in each moment and each day? How are you contributing to the peace in your life and the peace in your world? What things can you do on seemingly the insignificant levels of your daily life, knowing that they are carried into the world around us through this compounding, the butterfly effect, to become even greater expressions of peace?